of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Monday, May 9th, 2005. We will be opening a public hearing on House Bill 5036 and House Bill 5037, the health-related occupational licensing boards, and the fee bill. I'd like to call forward Gary Schnabel, Executive Director, Karen McLean, and Jim Gorris. And the first board on our agenda under this topic is the State Board of Pharmacy, and we'll be following this presentation with the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. I should point out that our chair is delayed, but should be arriving sometime soon. And who would like to start this morning?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Board of Pharmacy.
I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
Thank you. I'm used to that, though. My understanding is that you all have received a copy of the Governor's recommended budget with the pharmacy section in the binder.
Okay.
And you should have received a copy of the Board of Pharmacy's presentation packet for this morning. And rather than give you yet another handout to follow along with the PowerPoint, what we've done is followed the pharmacy presentation page by page, and each slide has the page number corresponding to the information in this packet, if you want to follow along that way to see more detail. I want to start right off and say why the Board of Pharmacy exists in the first place and what it is that citizens of the state of Oregon get from the Board of Pharmacy. ORS 689025 says that the practice of pharmacy in the state of Oregon is declared a professional practice affecting the public health, safety, and welfare and subject to regulation and control in the public interest. It is further stated to be a matter of public interest and concern that the practice of pharmacy, as defined in Chapter 689, merit and receive the confidence of the public, and that only qualified persons be permitted to engage in the practice of pharmacy in the state of Oregon. The mission statement that has been arrived at over the years through the board's strategic planning process is to promote, preserve, and protect the public health, safety, and welfare by establishing high standards in the practice of pharmacy and regulating the quality and distribution of drugs in Oregon. This is similar to what you've heard from some of the other small regulatory boards, but it's different also, and the difference is the dual role that's created by not only regulating the practice, the individual practice of the professionals, but also the quality of the drugs and the distribution of the drugs itself. And we'll see as we go through this presentation how that has really driven some of the board's expenses and costs. Goals, again, similar to what you've seen from some of the other small agencies, because we all work with the same progress board. Protect Oregon consumers by regulating the practice of pharmacy and the distribution of drugs. Provide excellent customer service and conduct business in a manner that supports a positive environment for the pharmacy industry. So a bit of the historical perspective. In the past, prior to maybe the mid-late 1980s, the focus of the Board of Pharmacy was really on examinations and licensing and on-site inspections of pharmacies. It was stuff really related to issues of pharmacy practice and basic competency of the pharmacist and professionalism of the pharmacist. More recently, activities have driven the board's focus more towards the distribution function, the quality of drugs and distribution piece, and more resources have been required to be devoted to the distribution piece more so than the actual qualifications of the pharmacist, although that still remains important and we still have to do both. High-profile issues have further complicated the playing field, and they have spotlighted and challenged the board's regulatory efforts. And some of the issues include the methamphetamine labs and precursor regulation, prescription drug diversion, pharmacy technician discipline and entry-level licensing, internet drug distribution and foreign drug importation plans and projects, wholesale drug outlet licensing, pharmacists refusing to dispense emergency contraceptives. We've all heard bits and pieces in the news about many of those subjects. Other issues also are driving the board's resource allocation in addition to the day-to-day licensing and compliance and operations, primarily increased requirements for state agency administrative interactions and increasing requests for agency participation on various task forces, committees, and work groups. Also, there are a number of current priorities that are on the back burner waiting for more of the board's attention. Just a few examples are the regulation of extemporaneous compounding prescription products by pharmacists, rewriting outdated rules and related to the practice of pharmacy and distribution, ethical and professional practice, medication therapy management under the Medicare Modernization Act, and remote prescription order entry and dispensing, electronic prescription transmission. There are a number of issues that are waiting for our attention. And probably one of the most serious in terms of recent historical perspective is the staff turnover that we've had. It's been really difficult to maintain the staff. We have six positions for pharmacists in the compliance section. In compliance alone in the past 3 years, seven pharmacists have resigned, five have been replaced, and two within the past 2 months, and one position currently remains vacant. Of the 16 total employee positions that we have, only four of those have been with the board for more than 3 years. Programs and target groups. Agency programs. This agency, like the other small boards, is programmed as one single program unit. For efficiency, we have organized internally into operational sections that you see here. Licensing is made up of three full-time equivalents and handles all the details related to licensing and examinations of pharmacists and pharmacy technicians and pharmacy interns, as well as all the drug outlets, and that adds up to approximately 16,000 licensees total. Compliance section is made up of seven FTEs, and it's responsible for conducting on-site inspections of pharmacies, responding to consumer complaints, conducting investigations, and interpreting laws and pharmacy rules, and providing information and consultation with all stakeholders regarding pharmacy and drug laws. The operations section includes the office manager, a receptionist, and an administrative secretary, and they're responsible for general office management, coordination of board meetings and functions, clerical and secretarial support, and contracts and purchasing. The administration section includes the executive director and the compliance director, and is responsible for the overall operation of the agency. It includes supervision of the operation, licensing, and compliance sections, and interpretation and implementation of board policy. The recovery program is staffed by a one-half FTE director position. It's a program designed for addressing chemically dependent pharmacists. And going on with programs and target groups, agency strategies that have been identified that that support long-term goals include working toward reducing the number of dispensing errors or misfilled prescriptions, exploring ways to better assess and appropriately respond to the public and other stakeholder interests in a timely manner, develop high standards in the practice of pharmacy more closely with Oregon State Pharmacists Association and Oregon State University College of Pharmacy to facilitate the transition of pharmacists to drug therapy managers and drug counseling specialists to function in a manner more consistent with their training and education. Increase the public's awareness of the Board of Pharmacy and the understanding of the services provided and expectations of pharmacists and pharmacies. And encourage pharmacists to turn non-judgmental product preparation tasks over to pharmacy technicians so that they can focus on their patient efforts. And the target groups, I've listed not the groups, but categories that these groups fall into, and there are an incredible number of groups that the pharmacy boards really have to maintain ongoing contact with. State professional associations such as the Pharmacists Association, the Nurses Association, the Medical Association, national professional industry associations such as PhRMA, the American Pharmaceutical Association, the Association, National Association of Chain Drug Stores, consumer groups such as the American Heart Association, the Cancer Society, the Lung Association, the Citizens Advocacy Center, and others. Federal regulatory agencies, including the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, and others. These all have some activity with drugs and drug distribution. Agency organization, we are a 7-member board appointed by the governor. We have 2 public members and 5 pharmacists. There are no quotas, but the pharmacist members are appointed to represent the state geographically and represent various practice settings and represent gender and ethnic diversity. So without quotas, we make an attempt to recommend people and recruit people, and the governor makes these appointments for us. Oh, that one. I didn't mention that our organizational chart for the staff, there are 15 and a half full-time equivalents, 16 employees, and Appendix B shows our organizational chart. And it's real busy, so we didn't want to flash it up here. It's easier to look at it on the paper in front of you.
Good morning, representatives of the committee. My name is Karen McLean. I'm the administrative director for the Board of Pharmacy. I'm going to speak a little bit about our performance measures, and if you'd like to speak about them more a little bit later or now, I'm happy to go into them further. But as we discussed earlier, our 3 primary goals are to protect Oregon consumers, to provide excellent customer service, and to support a positive environment for the industry. The goals that we've identified for key performance measures are the number of pharmacies that are inspected annually, the pharmacies that we do inspect that are in compliance, and the number of pharmacists that complete required continuing education on time. In addition, we have some customer service goals, the number of days to complete an investigation by our compliance staff, the number of days to process initial and renewal applications, and the final item is really to create a collaborative review process in order to evaluate our administrative rules on a regular basis. Earlier this year, we were asked to provide a copy of our prioritized administrative items list, and the agency, as it's already been mentioned, is one single program unit, but we've identified 5 areas that the agency operates in that primarily we've been able to separate our budget into those 5 areas, which is licensing and examinations, compliance, operations, administration, and the recovery program. And within those, all of them work interdependently upon one another. We have to have licensing in order to have the compliance issues. We have to have operations to assist with all of those things, and we need administration to pull all those things together. The recovery program is unique because it is a confidential program. It is off-site, and so at this point, that is the only piece that is separate from our main office staff. We've identified 10% reductions that are included in our materials here on page 8. It includes reductions to services and supplies and a reduction in our compliance area should the committee choose to go in that direction. The major budget drivers that we have include the fact that we interact with many state and federal agencies and that we must regulate not only the practice of pharmacy for the individuals but the distribution of drugs and devices by the drug outlets. In addition to that, the stakeholders that are both inside and outside of Oregon.
Also, go back to that. Must interact with many state and federal agencies. The almost daily contact that we have with the DEA and the FDA ends up driving some of our activities, and we have daily contact with the other health regulatory boards, actually every regulatory board that deals with professions that can prescribe or dispense or possess drugs or administer drugs. The things the Board of Pharmacy does that affect the drugs or that affect the prescription or the form and format could have an impact on those professions, and so we have to have really close contact and coordination with the medical board, the nursing board, and their associations. The agency's budget is driven primarily by the workload created through these requirements for research, rulemaking, and reporting, and it's impacted by the following environmental factors. Beginning in 2004, all pharmacists are required to earn a Doctor of Pharmacy degree as the basic entry-level degree program. All state boards of pharmacy now require the doctorate-level degree, and all the colleges of pharmacy in the U.S., including Oregon State College of Pharmacy, now requires the PharmD degree. Pharmacists are increasingly engaged in collaborative drug therapy management relationships with practitioners and patients. Disease state management refers to collaborative drug therapy management programs in which protocols are developed for specific disease states, for specific patients. Programs have been developed for management of patients with common diseases such as diabetes, asthma, hypertension, cholesterol, and others, and have become formalized within the recent Medicare Modernization Act as medication therapy management. Increasing use of technological advancements and automation in the prescribing, dispensing, and distribution of drugs also having a significant impact on the practice and on the regulation. Pharmacy technicians and clerks are being trained to perform many of the mechanical functions and preparing packaging medication and production functions that were previously performed by pharmacists. Technicians also have increasing access to prescription drugs and controlled substances, thus the temptation and the risk of drug diversion for personal use and illegal distribution has become more pervasive. More pharmacies than ever before are owned and operated by corporations. Many of these are large publicly held companies with complex business and financial structures and heavily staffed legal departments and government relations teams. Because of the many changes in the practice environment and in the pharmacy, the pharmaceutical industry's boards of pharmacy are being stressed by the demand for attention to their stakeholder issues. Changes in the focus of pharmacy practice and technological advances being incorporated into systems of drug distribution across the country will require increased devotion of resources and attention to administrative rules, statutes, policies that are rapidly becoming outdated and obsolete. The agency is being asked to contribute increasing time and resources to participate in a variety of new and ongoing activities with other state agencies, and issues driving this are such as bioterrorism planning and the CDC's National Pharmaceutical Stockpile, Medical Errors, Patient Safety Commission, healthcare workforce. We've even been asked to investigate a failed Death with Dignity Act attempt several weeks ago. So those kinds of requests for our time have been increasing. And again, the most serious challenge seems to be our high turnover and our inability to recruit and retain staff in our compliance section. Major agency program changes in the last 10 years. We have not had what we could call major program changes, although there have been a lot of internal reorganizations, and to us in the office, they seem pretty major, but it doesn't really change the program. It's been just enhancements and increasing workload. We've had to recruit and replace key staff. In the last 5 years, we recruited new executive director. It was almost 5 years ago, not quite. Since that time, we've had three compliance directors, two office managers, and then we're in our third administrative director now. So that turnover has been really a factor.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You commented on turnover a couple of times in your presentation. What is happening within the organization that is leading to so much turnover?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, what we're seeing mostly, two factors really. One is with the highest turnover being in our compliance section where the pharmacists are the investigators. These require pharmacist positions, and we're just not able to pay the kind of salary that attracts people that are able to stay for very long. It's the high workload and the salary that's being cited for their resignations. We've also had a number of retirements from the key long-term staff in the past several years. So, again, out of our 16 staff or employee positions, we've only got four that have been here more than 3 years.
And five of them are retirements.
And if I may follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the salary for the investigator position? And this is a person who's also a professional pharmacist. Right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the salary for pharmacists is approximately $65,000. If you were to go out into the marketplace and hire a brand new pharmacist that was coming right out of pharmacy school, they can make approximately $80,000. And our positions require require 5 years of experience before they can even work for the Board of Pharmacy. So there is quite a difference in the salary. Right. Excuse me. Those are also represented positions that are negotiated.
Just to follow up.
Yes.
That's not the total compensation. You also have to add about a 40% benefit package on the salary, didn't you?
Exactly. But
You're talking at $84,000. At a $60,000 salary, that's another $24,000. So, I mean, your salaries are... I'm just looking for salary schedule right here. Nice.
Senator Devlin, I would also mention that those salaries are base salaries, those $85,000 salaries that you would see a pharmacist at a Rite Aid or a Safeway. Those benefit packages are on top of that. It's in addition to. So that's part of what our employees are looking at, is their benefit packages that associate with their baseline salary are considerably lower than what they are in the marketplace. There's also sign-on bonuses that are incredible. $25,000, $30,000 in order to get people to come because they're desperate for pharmacists out there.
There's $197,000 total compensation. $157,000, $133,000, $186,000 within your board.
That's for 2 years, though.
That's for 2 years, yeah.
Please proceed.
Oh, yeah, recruiting staff. Yeah. Okay. We've also, again, not a program change, but a significant issue for our staff is the internal reorganization into the five distinct operating units of administration, licensing, operations, compliance, and recovery programs. Another one was the recent funding and staffing of the recovery program. Prior to 3 years ago, I guess, that it was all run by volunteers and we didn't have any staff. We were able to get a half-time position to be the director of that program. There is a five-person council then that works with that director, and that director reports to me, the executive director.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, could you comment further on the need? This is a problem in the profession, I guess, that you need to have a staff that's looking after the recovery or the drug addiction of your members. Is that what this position could do? Is that normal? Is other states having the same problem? Is that a nationwide trend within the profession? Is a recent trend, or could you comment further for us?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin. This is a common program around the country, and it's not just boards of pharmacy. It's all the health-related boards. The medical board has a program that's actually funded quite a bit more than ours is. Dentistry board, I don't know if theirs is up yet. They're working on one. But most of the health agencies have these programs, and it's not just programs for alcoholism like Alcoholics Anonymous or some of the other recovery programs. These also are related to drug addiction, chemical dependence, in the pharmacy world and in medicine and nursing and dentistry, anybody that has access to those kinds of drugs, and particularly in pharmacy, when their job is handling those drugs all the time, there's a risk. And so that's what this program addresses, those chemically dependent individuals. We haven't seen evidence of an increase in that. The program at this time has 42, I think, or in the low 40s. They certainly don't capture everybody that's there, but it's a program that has two components, a voluntary component where an individual can enter that program to get help and not be turned over to the Board of Pharmacy. They're allowed to practice and keep their license as long as they're not using and as long as they're participating in the program. If they fail or fall out of the program or start using again, then they do get turned over to the board. The other way that's used is if an individual gets caught, gets busted by the board, gets disciplined, the board can refer them into that program for their treatment. So there's a group in that program that the board doesn't know about because they're there voluntarily, and there's a group that the board has referred into.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And finally, it seems like the biggest deal for us in the office was the replacement of the agency's licensing and compliance database. That was a complete reorganization of our information technology system, and it's really, in just barely over a year now, has really made a difference. Steps taken to control costs and increase efficiency. When I took the position as executive director, we had four state-owned vehicles in a pool for the investigators to be on the road doing inspections and their investigations. Since that time, we've eliminated one of those vehicles and the corresponding parking space that goes with it. So now we have three vehicles that are shared with the six pharmacist positions in compliance for getting on the road. That's been working so far. We don't know how long it's going to keep working, but we'll keep at it as long as we can. We have not been able to get people on the road, partly because of workload inside the office. So there hasn't been a stress on those vehicles yet, but we're hoping that we'll be able to continue with those. We established a new agency website working with the state's programs, and that's been real helpful in eliminating a number of the phone calls and requests for information that we get. We put a lot of information on the website that people need. They can get it there and download it and don't have to call and ask questions. We're working on a license verification piece for that, so now people have to call up to verify a license or ask about discipline. Soon we will have that online so that they can type in a person's name and get the information about that person out of our database online. One of the significant things that we do that saves us a lot of money that we overlook is participating with the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. They manage and administer professional licensing and jurisprudence examinations. They develop and provide model rules and language for model acts, and they have a number of policy research committees that provide reports for the various states. So if we weren't devoting some time and effort to this, we'd be having to develop our own exams and administer our own exams and defend them psychometrically. That program has been really helpful. We've established interagency agreements with the Board of Nursing to share information technology, personnel, and resources. And we've established an interagency agreement with DAS, Shared Client Services, for accounting and financial services. Sharing those resources allow us to tap in and save money and things together, so we're not out there on our own for those. Oh, and the product identification label, I almost forgot. Wrote it down later. The accuracy label, we referred to that in 2000. Product identification label, or pill. Now we ask people to look for the pill on the label. This is a rule adopted by the board that required pharmacies to include the description of the product or a digital image of the tablet or capsule on the label itself. You can see from our statistics there, we implemented that rule in 2000, and the number of dispensing errors here. P peaked in 1999, and then with the advent of the accuracy label or the fill label, our errors have just gone down. I'd like to take credit for, but I can't, for what you may have heard recently in the news about Target pharmacies and the new prescription vial that they have, the shape of it that's upside down, and the big labeling. We were the first state to do something like that, and we like to think that we kind of stimulated the sensitivity about the labeling and the readability of the things, and so people have just taken off on that. Several other states now have adopted the same rule and require that on the label. What Target did was not required. They just took off on their own and did it.
At this point, we'll go ahead and switch over to major budget issues. Costs that are unique to the agency include high-profile cases, a staff turnover that has driven our AG costs, and really part of what that is the fact that our attorney general fees have skyrocketed in this last biennium. It's been dependent on the fact that we've had inexperienced staff in regards to legal issues in our office, and they've had a lot to learn. And we have had a lot of high-profile issues, such as pseudoephedrine issues. You name it. It's come our way this last biennium. We've had quite a lot of different kinds of things. In addition, we do have professional services contracts and purchasing contracts. The most significant is related to our licensing and compliance database, License 2000, that was upgraded about a year and a half ago. And we went through the entire process working with GAS procurement on that process. We do have one proposed change in revenue source that was not in our original binder, and that has to do with a fee that was created at the request of our stakeholders for what is called an automated pharmacy system. And it relates to being able to remote dispense. And there is technology available today that would allow a pharmacy in one community to have technology in another community in a secure location that they would be able to, through electronics, tell the machine to dispense a certain size vial that has a certain amount of prescription in it that would allow them to be able to get that prescription. So, for example, if they were 30 or 40 miles away and they need a prescription today and there was a valid reason for that to be dispensed, they would be able to do that. They would be able to counsel that person through a two-way camera, and they would be able to dispense that medication without the patient having to go 30 or 40 miles to the pharmacy. We implemented that rule in early March, and we established a fee of $100 for the machine itself to be implemented. And so we are asking for that fee to be ratified. We do not expect for a lot of those machines to be installed. Right now we have two places that are actually in the process of implementing that technology. And I would not expect that that will increase significantly in the coming biennium, but we did need to establish a fee, establish rules, and that is what we are requesting at this time. We do have five policy packages, and I'd like to go through those at this time. Our first policy package is 231. It has two reclassifications in it. Those reclasses have to do with the fact that we had one compliance secretary position who was an office specialist too, and in a review of her position and the responsibilities that have taken place over the last several years due to the changes in compliance, she's actually the employee that's been with our agency the longest. She's been there over 14 years. And part of what's happened is she's taken on new and additional responsibilities as the staff has changed. And part of that has been dependent on assisting with a lot of our legal documents and legal preparation that has to get done. She's taken on a significant amount of responsibilities there that are equivalent to an administrative specialist one. We did review that position with HRSD, and it was approved, and we have been working her out of class for a period of time and pending this reclassification. The second reclassification came when we had one of our pharmacist positions that was also a manager resign last year. He was with the agency for a long time, and we couldn't figure out how we were going to fill that historical perspective position with somebody who had no experience with the agency. And so at that time, we did have some candidates that were available. We chose at that time to fill an inspector position instead of a manager position in order to get some staff on board and get them trained. And at this time, that format is working better for us than the other format was. We do have two new positions that we are requesting. One is a project manager, and the other is a pharmacist consultant. The project manager position we do anticipate will assist with rule writing, will assist with coordinating our research councils and facilitating the process of moving along some of those research projects and high-profile things that we're asked to be a part of, task forces that we're asked to be a part of, bioterrorism, methamphetamine task force, you name it, the kinds of things that we're asked to do that right now there's really no people to be involved with. And both of those positions really do work together. We expect that the pharmacist consultant position will really take on some of those pharmacy technical questions and be able to assist the executive director and the compliance department in moving those projects along. Right now, those are really, like Executive Director Schnabel said earlier, on the back burner. Our next package is 232, and it has to do with facilities and space. The agency, over the last 10 years or so, has grown by several staff, and the agency has been in the same space for all of that time. So each time we've had a new staff person come on board, we've just condensed a little bit more and tried to work with the space that we had available to us. In the last 2 years, I don't know if you've heard about this or not, but in the Portland State Office Building, there was a child care center on the first floor, daycare center, and that has been vacant for the past 2 years. We've been working very closely with DAS facilities on this, and there are some needs amongst the other boards on the fourth floor to be able to make some shift in space. The Board of Nursing needs some additional space. The Board of Pharmacy needed additional space. And so at this time, the board has a package to request to move down to the first floor, and that would include our moving costs for the first floor, and there's also additional rent that would be included in this package. Our third package has to do with our move to shared client services. As been mentioned before, we were able to move to shared client services in October of last year to get... Sure.
Yes, Representative Wilson.
There's going to be other costs to that facility, aren't there? You're going to raise the sink. I've been in the facility. I mean, is that going to cover your remodel of the facility, too?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
There's going to be additional costs to that building. Is it $161,000 to that, the daycare, to accommodate you?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett. DAS Facilities is assuming the costs for reworking that space and making it ready for offices to be in that location, so that there won't be additional costs to the agency.
Right.
Yeah, they recognized that at the time with all the little potties and all the plumbing that's in there. So, yeah.
The sink will be raised up.
That all will be coming out. So, our move to shared client services. Our accounting services up until October were obtained through the Department of Human Services. And that format has been in place for many, many years, long before I arrived at the board. And it has become clear over the last several years that DHS is really tapped out, and they are not able to provide the services that we need in order to do financial analysis for our agencies. So we sought assistance through the Department of Administrative Services, and we were able to move our accounting services to shared client services. And since that time, that has made a tremendous difference. It does relate to House Bill 2058 and finalizing that process for our board. The next policy package has to do with our prescription drug monitoring program, and it is policy package 235. This program is really dependent on Senate Bill 180. It is a program that creates a prescription drug reporting program, whereas controlled substances would have to be reported through an electronic database to the Board of Pharmacy. It would help us to identify drug seekers and diversion that's happening in the state. At this time, that bill has gone through a couple of hearings, and we're not sure if it's going to pass out of committee, but we do have a policy package that would add 2.5 positions. It would add some space for those folks, and it would also add the resources necessary to run that program for the biennium.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Can you tell us how that work will relate to performance measure one, the percentage of inspected pharmacies that are in compliance annually? Is there a relationship?
Senator Devlin, Representative Gorley, Senator Gorley, no, there isn't a relationship at this time. It would be a compliance requirement of them to report, but it really is a totally separate confidential program, and that's one of the things that's unique about it. It would be a program that we have federal funds for. We sought and obtained a federal grant for this program. Everything about it is confidential, and it would just simply be another requirement on the pharmacies to report. So at this point, I would not anticipate that that would relate directly to a performance measure that we have in existence today.
No, it's protecting working. Mr. Chair, Senator Gorley, performance measure about pharmacies in compliance, that has to do with pharmacies undergoing an on-site inspection by one of our pharmacist investigators and whether they find violations or not during that inspection. That's all that refers to. There may be other violations or other issues going on that's not part of that statistic.
The concern I'm raising here, Mr. Chair, looking at that key performance measure, it seems that it isn't very aggressive. For 2004, if I'm reading this correctly, 65% of pharmacies inspected were in compliance in 2004.
Senator Devlin, Senator Gorley, excuse me. Part of what that statistic is dependent on is actually getting out and inspecting, and it has to do with the number of places that are actually in compliance at the time of the inspection. It's not that we haven't tried to get out there and do it, but that's been because we've had the staff changes that we've had. That has been the most challenged thing in our office, is actually getting out and doing those inspections. And part of that is dependent on finding, you know, issuing warning notices is how that statistic is determined.
I guess I'm questioning the wisdom of taking on additional work in an agency that's struggling to keep up with what you have on your plate. So if you could address that in your comments, that would be very helpful.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Senator Gorley, are you referring to the package and the drug monitoring program?
Yes, I am.
Being the extra work, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This program is similar to programs that have been developed around the country. There are 23 other states, I think, now that have programs like this for drug abuse prevention, early intervention. It would increase our workload, but it would provide the revenue to add the necessary staff to administer the program. So it wouldn't be stressing, except for the development phase where we're putting it together and hiring the staff. It would be a workload issue for us, but for running the program, there would be adequate staff to do that.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, is this $350,000 grant, is that a reoccurring grant or is that a one-time grant?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, this is a one-time grant. They have provided this grant program each of the last 3 years in a row, and they anticipate they'll have it again next year. I'm not sure how long it will last. It's the Harold Rogers Grant Program is funds appropriated by Congress that are administered through the Department of Justice. And states who are developing drug abuse prevention programs like this can apply every year when that program is available. But each grant is a one-time grant.
On that basis, being a one-time grant with the potential, there's a potential of renewal, right, if the dollars are reappropriated. But what would the agency's intent be, you know, in a future biennium if the dollars are not reappropriated for it, the program?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've talked about that, and we've been asked about that, too, every time we present it. It's we do plan to apply for a second grant, and we've talked to the people at the grant program. They know we plan to apply. What we're going to have to do with this one, in fact, is to get an extension because the grant period coinciding with our legislative session put us halfway through the grant period to begin with, so they know that we're going to ask for an extension on this one and a renewal. If we're not successful in getting a second grant, and whether we are or not, at some point we're going to have to find a stable funding source. What we've been doing is talking to the other licensees, and we will expect that the cost of the program will be shared by all the professional licensees that deal with prescribing or dispensing. It would be the physicians and nurse practitioners, the dentists, all the people that prescribe, whether it would be a part of their license or an additional fee. What we're hoping to do with the grant is to have the program running for 2 years or 3 years without cost, to show them the value of it and hope that they'd be willing to pay for it when the time comes. That's been the experience in some of the other states that have the program. The practitioners like the information they can get from this program.
Going back for a moment also into your performance measures, we've come back to several of them a couple of times, so I don't know if we'll come back and spend a great deal of time on them, but when your inspections are down to, I guess in 2003, which is your last reported year, 27%, do you selectively choose which pharmacies that you are going to inspect, or is it simply random?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the past we were fortunate enough to be able to inspect every pharmacy annually, and that's been sort of the goal. Directly to your question, we do target pharmacies that have been a problem in the past, pharmacies that we have heard something about, or a pharmacy that has not been inspected for a long time. That's the criteria that we use when we put a list together.
Another question, knowing that this might get some less than positive reaction, have you ever explored the idea that you might need different level of inspectors or investigators, and that some inspectors might not have to be actually licensed pharmacists? I've looked at your checkoff form that you have in terms of inspecting a pharmacy, and it's extremely expensive. But at the same time, I don't know if it would require the level of training of a pharmacist to basically inspect most of the items.
Sure, Mr. Sheriff, and thanks for that question. That's a good discussion, and I'll be kind of brief on it. We have had that discussion on a number of occasions, and we've thought about maybe hiring a pharmacy technician or somebody who knows the language to go in with that form if it's only a checkoff list. And we could do that if it was only a checkoff list, and we might be able to get to that point. This one is really more than a checkoff list. It's an educational tool that shows the pharmacist or whoever staff in the pharmacy does that what's important to the board. It shows them where in the rule or statute that applies or the answer is found. We review that form every year, and it changes from time to time when something becomes more important or when we're seeing an issue that we want to stress, we'll put that in that form. Pharmacy inspectors in British Columbia, they're called pharmacist consultant. There's a name anyway. That in British Columbia, we research what some other states do just for this purpose. They have, as you suggested, a person who just goes down to do a checklist once in a while. And then they have a pharmacist that will go in and spend an extended amount of time periodically, less frequently, and actually consult with the pharmacist about best practice or about other issues that they found on their checklist. So your suggestion is well taken, and we do look at that, and we'll continue.
How much time is left? Are you still at the international drug outlet?
About 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay.
Thank you. Our final policy package is 237, international drug outlet licensing. And this package is really included in our budget at the request of the governor's office. It relates to Senate Bill 192 and is an alternative to the governor's Pioneer Prescription Drug Plan. Last fall, as you may remember, the governor requested the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services allow Oregon a waiver to import drugs safely through wholesalers in Canada. At this time, there has been a little activity on that request for that waiver. I know that there's been a couple of presentations before different committees giving updates on that. But at this point, the board is simply available to do that. If this waiver does not go through, this Senate Bill 192 would be an alternative. We don't know a lot of information about it, but we were asked to include it in our budget as a policy package, and there are many unknowns related to it. So that's really all I can share with you about that. Finally, our ending balance, the way our budget is prepared today, would include about 7.4 months of ending balance. and we believe that that's a minimum of what we would need to operate, depending on the cash flow of our agency. And finally, there is the proposed legislation that the agency has is House Bill 2058 that relates to our accounting and financial services, Senate Bill 180, and then the Senate Bill 192 that relates to the international drug outlet licensing. Finally, we don't want to omit including information about Senate Bill 786 that has to do with diversity. One of the things that we did this last biennium was we asked all of our licensees to respond to us and provide diversity information. We do have two charts that are in your materials under Appendix H. And the first one includes the ethnic breakdown of all the licensed pharmacists in the that are licensees of ours, and the second has to do with the different languages that are included. So of the people that responded, we were able to gather quite a bit of information. We do have quite a diverse background as far as languages. We have worked very closely with the Oregon State College of Pharmacy on how they have people enter into their program, and we were able to see some changes there, and we also participate with them and talk with them about how folks get into the program. We've been involved with trying to solicit board members that are from other ethnic diversity groups, such as the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, but at this point we did not get any response from them. But we do have one Asian female on our board, one African American male, and five whites, three female, and two female, three male. So we do have a diversity amongst our board and amongst our profession, and we will continue to work on that as requested. Thank you very much.
As part of that process, in terms of the breakdown of licensed pharmacists, it's in the booklet that you first sent out. Have you checked with other agencies? Is your it's a voluntary probably checkoff on your registration form, but it seems like a relatively high no indication number. You've got about 4 out of every 10 people not indicating.
We do have an extra sheet of paper that goes out with every single one of our applications, and it is voluntary. And I believe that that's the case for all of the other boards, that it's voluntary information that's provided.
Okay. But it's a relatively high level of non-indication compared to some other agencies. Any additional questions? Yes, Senator Gordley, and then we will actually, your question may lead into that, see if there are any additional questions on performance measures.
Okay. Two quick questions. One on the Senate Bill 786 diversity report and compliance. When you do get that information from Oregon State University regarding the entering class of 2004, would appreciate you passing that along. I note here that in your report you're indicating that the information is unavailable for 2004.
They were just
time.
In the process of compiling that report, and they weren't able to give it to me.
And then also, looking back at the performance measures, performance measure number 4, the number of days to complete an investigation from complaint to board presentation, what you're telling us is that it's going to take an increasing number of days to complete these investigations. In 2004, the number of days to complete was 60, staying at 60 for 2005, but then I think in 2007, you're moving up to 90 days. Again, is that related to workload and the issues around not enough staff? What's happening here?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, the answer to that question is simply when I was looking at this information last year, part of what happens is our board meets every other month, and it's the timing more than anything else of the timing between the when a complaint might come in could be right after the board meets, and it may not be able to have that investigation completed prior to the next board meeting. So the reality is it may be a little bit longer, closer to 90 days, that an investigation is completed from beginning to end. It's one thing to have it reported to the board within 60 days to let the board know that there's an ongoing investigation, but to actually have a PACE completed and have all of that work done within 90 days sometimes is impossible. And I was just simply trying to true up those numbers and make it more accurate to what's probably really happening out there.
I guess my last comment, Mr. Chair, would be that we really need an agency that has the resources to inspect pharmacies, to inspect 100% of the pharmacies, not just a percentage of them. This is an agency that is charged with protecting the public. It has, there's a public safety component here. And so anything less than every pharmacy, I think, is unacceptable.
Chair. Senator Nelson, and then Representative Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much will the fee increases be, and are you, do pharmacists different than pharmacy technicians, pharmacies, outlets, and that type of thing? How, how are you going to come to this fee increase?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we are proposing a fee increase at this time.
You aren't?
We don't have a fee increase.
You're raising more money. Is that just
we're only establishing.
Sorry. We're establishing one new fee, and that is only for that remote dispensing machine.
That's okay.
And that's only people who request it for remote areas. We've got two of those so far. We probably will not get a dozen. Probably not half a dozen in this biennium. The increase in overall budget partly reflects that $350,000 federal grant for Package 235.
Oh, I've just seen from the 203 estimate of the governor's recommended budget, there's almost $1 million, about $900,000. $350,000 is federal funds, and then there's licensing fees. It's like there's $300,000.
Numbers.
I mean, is it just more pharmacists, or what? I mean, what's happening? That's the only other answer, I guess.
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, I would also mention that part of what that number is reflecting is that we did have a fee increase in the 01-03 biennium, which increased our ending balance. And the expectation was, at the time, that we would be able to implement our new database system and add a couple of staff. And part of the reason that we're not increasing any fees at this time is because we do have the ending balance adequate to cover the things that we are requesting.
Yeah. Thank you for clarifying.
And those were
expected. I was looking for a fee, and I couldn't see any.
Thank
you. There's a pretty big jump in money there.
It is. We recognize that.
Representative Winston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you comment on your board selection? Do you seek any geographic representation, and do you also seek a private, you know, corner store pharmacist versus a...
Senator Devlin, Representative Wisnett, yes, we do. We have one of our chair of our pharmacy, our board is actually from Riddle, Oregon. He has his own independent pharmacy. And we do have representatives from Eastern Oregon, and we do our best to get it around the state, but it's very hard. We had somebody that wanted to be a board member, I think, from Enterprise. She might have been the mayor of Enterprise, and she was unable to fulfill that position. She wanted to, but circumstances made it impossible for her to participate. So, yeah, we look at different ways to have involvement.
Any additional? Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, Mr. McClain, could you share your understanding of how Senate Bill 192 comports with, first, the United States patent laws protecting manufacturers, and then, secondly, how it comports with Food and Drug Administration regulations relating to foreign manufactured drugs?
Okay. Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt. I'm not sure about the drug patent laws and how that would apply. As far as how it relates to the FDA, and the governor's Pioneer Prescription Project plan was to get a permission for a waiver from the FDA for certain applicable importation laws that prevent drugs from being imported. This Senate Bill 192 would only come into play in the absence of that waiver as a plan B. So Senate Bill 192 sort of ignores the issue of those importation requirements. So if this were implemented, you know, this is Oregon, we would be authorized by state law to allow foreign importers to send drugs into Oregon.
Can I follow up?
It wouldn't change federal law, but it would make it allowable under state law, is my understanding.
So we would pass a law that would authorize Oregon to violate federal law.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I guess you could say it that way. I mean, I have said it that way before, but it's similar. Well, I don't think I want to go there. It's not intended to encourage people to violate federal law. What it is meant to do is make it allowable in Oregon and be silent on what the federal law says.
Thank you very much. At this point, we'll go to Mr. Gores.
Thank you, and I'll make it brief. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Gores. DAS, or Department of Administrative Services, Budget Management Division. Very briefly, as you've probably seen these many times before, this presentation in front of you. This board is in the Consumer and Business Services Program area, and they're part of what is called the health-related licensing boards. Of the Consumer Business Services area, they comprise 0.9% of that program area. Of that group of agencies, pharmacy comprises 55.4% of the budget for those boards. This board fell under the health and basic needs of the governor's principal budget. They have a total budget of $4,095,957 total funds. Of that, $3.7 million is other funds, and then $350,000 is that grant that we talked about for the prescription drug monitoring program, and that's federal funds. Their sources of revenue are licensing fees and then the one federal grant. Of that budget amount, services and supplies comprises 31% of their budget. Personal services comprises 69%. On page 7, you kind of see a history of their budget, and I'll be happy to answer any questions on that, but I won't go into any detail on that. Major policy issues. Both Karen and Gary did a very good job of going into those. Other than maybe addressing the fact that there is still pharmacist shortage out there that these folks also have to work to address, just as we're seeing shortages in nursing and other medical fields, pharmacists are also having a problem getting recruiting, and there's going to be a lot of retirements too in the future, so that's another policy issue that they need to deal with, and I won't go into the policy packages unless you wish me to.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we go on to the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board, Representative Butler will be coming in to testify on the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. So, is he on his way?
I thought he was next door. He is not, so I'm fast time to call him.
Well, I will modify my last statement, and whenever we can get Representative Butler here, we will go to him. But Mr. Coach, could you come forward? I should ask actually also if there's anyone else here to testify on the State Board of Pharmacy. Is there anyone? No. Coach, whenever you're ready to proceed, but also let you know that as soon as Representative Butler comes in, I'll probably have to interrupt you for a few minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is David Coe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. This morning, what I'd like to do is, if there's time, walk you through a number of issues important to the board. I'll first talk for a moment about the board's mission statement, provide some historical perspectives, provide some information about the board's programs and target groups, talk about organization and program delivery, discuss performance measures, talk about major budget drivers and environmental factors, some major changes in the past 10 years, give you a little bit of an idea of what the board has done in an effort to contain costs and improve program delivery, and then focus on some major budgetary issues having to do with a revenue shortfall. I also will go through the board's policy packages and talk a bit about ending cash balance. And at the tail end of my written presentation are some comments about Senate Bill 76 and the board's efforts to comply with that legislation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I also have a request, which won't come as a surprise to Mr. Coe, and good afternoon, good morning to you, I should say. You indicate in your one of the documents we've received from your agency outlining some recent investigations that there was received just a couple of weeks ago, and I'm referring now to your written document on page 2. Just a couple of weeks ago, a complaint alleging overtly racist slurs against African Americans and corpse abuse by a funeral home manager in Portland, widely reported in the news media. And what I would ask you to do, Mr. Coe, as you are making your presentation before the committee this morning, is please describe in whatever detail you can, given that there are legal constraints. I understand that. But describe in as much detail as possible the approach and activities currently ongoing related to investigating the allegations of racist slurs and racist slurs against African Americans and corpse abuse by a funeral home manager in Portland. I would like that response to be on the record along with my request, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Coe and Senator Gordley, we will get to that when we get to your presentation, and I hope you'll spend some time on it. Representative Butler has just come into the room, and I know he needs to get back to another committee. Representative Butler, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. I come to you today with a concern that we frequently have from rural Oregon, and that is it appears that when these boards come out to examine small facilities such as my small mortuaries in rural eastern Oregon, frequently they check the good sense and leave it behind somewhere. And the concern that I have is that frequently the only contact that we'll have with these boards and their investigators is just when they've come out to tell us what it is that we're doing wrong in the small mortuaries in rural and eastern Oregon. And in particular, those places where I have difficulties trying to keep up with the building codes and complying with building codes issues, and then finding out that the building codes never coordinated their issues with the mortuary board, and the mortuary board then comes in and says, well, we want it this way, and the building code says we want it that way, and it leaves these smaller operations in situations where we've got two conflicting state agencies. Now, I realize that's not as much of a problem here in the valley along the I-5 corridor, because we can usually reach out and get both of them to show up at these places at the same time so that the two agencies can coordinate their demands on these small operators and can get their demands such that they can coordinate them in such a fashion that they can arrive at some agreement. But the difficulties is that when I only see one agency every 6 months and then I see the other agency every other 6 months, that one agency will make a decision which affects another, which affects the agency's power in another agency, and I get these dueling agency situations. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the fact that there is certain demands by the mortuary board to have more fees on these small operators, and that those fees are going to be used for these long distance forays out into the hinterlands of the state of Oregon to make sure that we can make these country cousins that we have out there somehow comply with these rules. But I would just ask you that they not check the common sense at Mount Hood when they leave Western Oregon.
Thank you very much, Representative Butler.
Thank you.
Mr. Coe. Well, Mr. Coe, you thought you were going to come here today and be an expository speaker, but you are actually going to be an expository and an impromptu or extemporaneous speaker. So,
Mr. Chair, it's always good to hear from Representative Butler, and I think I know a little of the situation that he's speaking about. It may have to do with the location of the door to what's called a prep room where human remains are embalmed. And the board has a rule that prohibits the door to the prep room from opening onto a public passageway. And that rule, of course, tends to protect the licensee as well as consumers. There have been circumstances where doors were inadvertently left open and a sensitive person or family member or child might look in there and see something that neither the licensee nor the board nor the consumer wants to see. There are circumstances, and I'm not certain that this is the issue that Representative Butler has in mind. There are circumstances where we have older homes that have been converted to funeral homes, and the board has made accommodations under those circumstances by asking the licensee, rather than to remodel the funeral home, what we ask them to do is install some sort of a self-closing, automatically locking door, and then the board would consider the licensee to be in substantial compliance if that's the case. I'm not sure that's the issue that Representative Butler has in mind, but I will follow up with Representative Butler and see if I can't figure that out, determine whether or not the board and its staff has behaved appropriately under those circumstances. I will say that the fact that we have got our website now up and running has been a great benefit for some of our licensees in rural eastern Oregon. They now have direct access to a lot of information on the board's website. I'd like to also, if I may, comment on the board's inspection process and demands. We don't really have the resources to impose discipline on licensees every time we find a violation. What we've done is try to establish, I think this gets to Representative Butler's comment about using common sense. The board, when it conducts an inspection, notes violations. We consider the inspection process to be more of a compliance audit than an effort to determine that licensees are breaking the law. It's only in egregious and repetitive situations where the board would propose discipline against a licensee where violations are noted during inspection. The typical process would be for the inspector to identify the violations and then talk about them with whoever happens to be at the funeral home at the time. What we do there is explain which rule or law has been violated and how to correct it, and we negotiate a time frame for the completion of those corrective actions. Then we send a follow-up letter to the establishment manager so that we're sure that someone in charge understands what the violations are, and we request voluntary corrective action. We don't have a book of tickets. We're not state troopers. We're not issuing speeding tickets. We simply request that licensees voluntarily correct the violations that we've noted. When a licensee feels for some reason that the board has misinterpreted a rule or statute, that licensee has the right to decline to voluntarily correct that situation, at which point the board would take it up, decide whether or not it is a violation, and if so, what a violation, what sort of corrective action is required. So we do this pretty much on a voluntary basis, and if it was not for the willingness of our licensees to voluntarily take corrective action, we would have much less compliance than we do at the moment.
Also, Mr. Coe, can you comment to the degree possible on the issue that Senator Gorley brought forward?
I very much want to do that, and I am going to try and avoid talking about the specifics of that case and speak hypothetically as best I can. But I will say some things that are specific about how the board addressed this complaint. First of all, the complaint is unusual in that the complainant himself posted the complaint. This is the letter addressed to the board's investigator. Posted that complaint on a website, so it's there, available for public consumption. Because the board considered the allegations to be so serious in several respects, we immediately gave it the highest possible priority. We have two investigators and a compliance manager. Prior to becoming the executive director, I was the board's investigator, and my background includes 20 years of civil rights experience as an investigator and a supervisor. So we immediately began looking into the matter. We've interviewed a number of witnesses a number of times. There was an initial rush to see if we couldn't figure out what was happening, and obviously, again, I'm going to try and be hypothetical. We can always follow up informal interviews on the telephone by issuing subpoenas and bringing witnesses into our office and putting them under oath and doing our best in these kinds of he said, she said situations to ensure that licensees understand the seriousness of the issues, and that as licensees of the board, sometimes our witnesses have their own careers on the line as well as anyone else who might be involved. We've also been in close contact with our assigned Assistant Attorney General, Raul Ramirez, and by close contact, I don't mean one telephone call. I mean three or four calls a day to figure out where precisely these kinds of investigations ought to be heading. I'm going to try and branch a little further into the hypothetical because I don't want to violate the health-related licensing board confidentiality laws, but I will say that under normal circumstances, when the board receives a complaint, whatever kind of damage that is alleged is done. It's not going to get any worse. The question is whether or not the harm that was done constitutes a violation of the board's rules or laws, and if so, what should the board do about it? There are other circumstances where the damage is not necessarily done. It may be ongoing. Under those circumstances, the Administrative Procedures Act gives the board authority to issue what's known as an emergency suspension order. But the board can only issue that sort of an emergency suspension order when the board finds that there's a serious danger to the public health, safety, or welfare. Even after the board makes that finding, the board has to explain that finding in its notice. In other words, we would have to explain why it is the board found that there was a serious danger to the public health. I don't want to talk about this case. I will say that there was a special meeting of the board. I can't recall the date right now. It was last Friday, I believe, and it could have been May 2nd, but I can't recall the date precisely. So, Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I can't talk about the details of this case, but I think you have the impression that the board took this very seriously and acted on it appropriately.
Follow-up?
Senator Gordon.
Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Mr. Cohen. Again, I appreciate the two conversations I believe we've had about the matter. I do want to thank you for your response to my office and also the obvious professionalism you're bringing to this serious situation and task. I do want to ask what assurances you can give to consumers of services provided by the funeral home in question. What assurances can you give to those consumers that they can go forward with any requests for or need for services they may have?
Well, certainly the spotlight has been shining on a particular facility, and I think that spotlight is intense, and what the board has done is, again, it's very awkward, but the board has taken the matter of whether or not there is any continuing jeopardy to the public safety, health, and welfare directly under advisement, and so
that is the question. That is the question, Mr. Chair. If there is that jeopardy,
I really have. I'm at a loss, except to say that when the board took no action upon the returning from its executive session, where these things must be discussed by law and behind closed doors, when the board came from executive session back into public session, the board made no decision. The board is required by law to make its decisions in public. Now, frequently, always, those decisions are made by case number, not by name, because of the confidentiality laws. So I guess it's a matter of reading between the lines, and that seems rather silly, but sometimes the confidentiality law puts us in an awkward position of appearing rather silly.
Is the Department of Justice here today?
I wouldn't know.
Mr. Chair, I'm comfortable that Mr. Cole has said as much as he is able to say on this public record. However, I would request that we ask the Department of Justice, and I believe it's Mr. Ramirez, to also get us some information for the record that clarifies what role is being carried forward by the Department of Justice in this particular matter.
Okay. We can see that's done. Okay. Mr. Cole, can you now proceed through your regular presentation?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the mission of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare by fairly and efficiently performing its licensing, inspection, and enforcement duties, by promoting professional behavior and standards in all facets of the Oregon death care industry, and by maintaining constructive relationships with licensees, those they serve, and others with an interest in the board's activities. The board has no primary links to Oregon benchmarks. As a high-level outcome, the board looks up to its mission statement. From the historic perspective, I would otherwise be brief with this portion of the board's presentation, except that it relates rather directly to Senate Bill 53, which is also before this committee for its consideration. I hope you'll bear with me while I go back through some of the history that led to the establishment of the death certificate filing fee in 1985. 20 years ago, this agency was known as the State Mortuary Board. At the time, the board's regulatory authority was limited to funeral directors, embalmers, and funeral homes. Although there were some laws on the books, no one had responsibility for cemetery and crematory regulation. Then in 1984, Lincoln City Police discovered 15 decomposing bodies in funeral director Dale Omsberg's garage. Twice as many were later found in mass graves at Omsberg's nearby cemetery. Most had been entrusted to Omsberg for cremation. As news of the atrocity emerged, survivors who had already received what they thought were ashes back from Omsberg demanded to know what had actually become of their loved ones. Unfortunately, there was no paper trail for law enforcement officials to follow. Some remains were never identified, others were never found. The families who trusted Omsberg suffered enormous heartache. In response to the tragedy, a task force composed of victims, industry leaders, and government officials proposed major reforms that were passed during the 1985 legislative session. Still unique today, those reforms called for a combined regulatory scheme at a time when other states were regulating the various segments of the industry separately, if at all. In addition to funeral directors, embalmers, and funeral homes, the new Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board was assigned responsibility for licensing and regulating the activities of cemeteries, mausoleums, columbariums, crematories, and immediate disposition companies. The board was also given a statutory mandate to conduct random inspections of all licensed facilities. Above and beyond consumer protection, the legislature's intent was to ensure that human remains are treated with dignity. All licensed facilities are now required to maintain detailed, accurate, and permanent records documenting the handling of human remains at every step from the place of death to the place of final disposition. In order to carry out its new duties, the board received additional compliance staff, additional investigative powers, and the authority to conduct criminal background checks on licensed applicants. Although it's not mentioned in my written presentation, those reforms go far beyond this. There were major changes in at least five chapters of the Oregon revised statutes, not just the board's organic statute, but also ORS Chapter 97 and ORS Chapter 432 and the medical examiner chapter. All sorts of new reforms were put in place in 1985. For revenue to support such wide-ranging funeral, cemetery, and crematory reforms, the legislature established a $5 death certificate filing fee. Although the filing fee was raised by $2 in 1993 to provide revenue for the Indigent Burial Fund administered by the Department of Human Services, the $5 portion that supports board programs has not been increased since the filing fee was first established 20 years ago.
Mr. Cole, I'm going to ask you to take a breath right there while I open a hearing on Senate Bill 53, public hearing on Senate Bill 53, which is the death certification filing fee, and please go forward.
Thank you very much, Senator Gordley. It's hard to say how many bad things have not happened since the Omsberg reforms were enacted. What can be said is that while other states have experienced some rather gruesome problems recently, Oregon has not had another scandal like the one in Lincoln City since 1985. Consumers in the Medford area did suffer the financial equivalent of the Omsberg incident in 1998 when more than $6 million was found missing from a prepaid funeral trust fund controlled by funeral home and cemetery owner David Kern. That case affected more than 4,000 families. After years of negotiation, the money was restored, Mr. Kern went to prison, and the legislature once again passed major reforms designed to protect the public from people like David Kern. As a few of the board's more recent investigations will illustrate, the need for effective oversight continues. In one case, a licensee is alleged to have overcharged 77 families a total of more than $18,000. In another, two licensees attempted to exploit a couple in their 90s by obtaining control of their estate and naming themselves as beneficiaries. In a third case, a licensee is alleged to have stolen more than $200,000 from a cemetery trust fund. In a fourth, a licensee was recently released after spending 6 months in county jail for stealing $40,000 in prepaid funeral trust funds. And as we just talked about just a couple of weeks ago, there was a manager of a funeral home in Portland who was accused of overtly racist slurs and corpse abuse. I mention these examples not to discredit the industry, but instead to demonstrate the importance of the work the board is doing. Every industry has its undesirable element. Obviously, it's in everyone's best interest for the board to take appropriate action when violations occur. Licensees understand that when families are victimized by a few, the entire industry may be called upon to defend itself. There are approximately 62,000 deaths per biennium in Oregon. The board's programs affect those who have suffered a loss, those who make and pay for final arrangements, and those who provide death care goods and services. It's the board's responsibility to license and regulate the practice of those engaged in the care, preparation, processing, transportation, and final disposition of human remains. The board licenses individual death care professionals and the facilities where they work. As of April 12, 2005, the board's 2,185 licensees included 637 funeral service practitioners, 487 embalmers, 97 apprentices, 12 interns, 206 pre-need salespeople, 189 funeral establishments, 11 immediate disposition companies, 488 cemeteries, and 58 crematories. I should also mention that where cemeteries and crematories and even funeral homes are concerned, there are several thousand more people who work there and who are required to abide by the board's rules and regulations, even though they do not hold personal professional licenses. They work for the crematories and the cemeteries and the funeral homes. The board's principal activities may be divided into three components: one, licensing and examination; two, compliance; and three, administration. Each component has some responsibility for providing information and technical assistance to licensees and the public. There are three major aspects to the board's compliance program: facility inspection, complaint investigation, and background investigation. Under organization and program delivery, I'm now on page 3 of the written presentation. The board is composed of 11 members appointed by the governor: 2 funeral service practitioners, 1 embalmer, 3 cemetery representatives, 1 crematory representative, and 4 public members. The board has a full-time staff of 6, including an executive director, office manager, licensing specialist, compliance manager, and 2 investigators. The board's office is located in the Portland State Office Building. Meetings are held 6 times each year. Compliance staff travels statewide to conduct complaint investigations and random inspections of licensed facilities. License application forms and a variety of information used for the licensees and the general public are now available on the board's website. The board receives fiscal services currently from the Department of Human Services, and information systems support are obtained through a multi-agency agreement with the Board of Nursing. The board also has an interagency agreement with the Office of Administrative Hearings and a personal services contract for database management and development. The board's current organization chart appears on budget page 87. The board's performance measures may be found on budget page 63. The first 4 measures are directly linked to the board's statutory mandates for licensing, facility inspection, complaint investigation, and background investigation. Measure number 5 relates to promoting professional standards and behavior. Measure number 6 is designed to gauge customer satisfaction with the information provided on the board's website. For the reasons set forth in column 4 on budget page 65, the board is seeking approval for a relatively minor modification to key performance measure number 3 concerning the timeliness of complaint investigations. In short, the board believes that the requested modification will yield data that are more comprehensive, reliable, and meaningful. As explained above, the board's budget is driven by legislative mandates that require background checks, examination, licensing, inspection, and complaint investigation. A discussion of the environmental factors affecting the board may be found beginning on budget page 49. With respect to major program changes, the board has not had a major reorganization since the Omsberg reforms in 1985. However, there have been some significant changes in the past 10 years. In 1997, the law requiring mandatory complaint investigation and investigative confidentiality was passed. Prior to 1997, the board's investigative
authority was discretionary, not mandatory. That has somewhat of an impact on how the board conducts its affairs. Currently, when the board receives a complaint from any person against a licensee or applicant, the board has no discretion in whether or not to investigate. The statute says thou shalt investigate. The board's sanctioning authority, however, continues to be discretionary. The statute says that the board may impose discipline. It doesn't say that the board has to impose discipline. And in 2001, the bill passed requiring mandatory use of the Office of Administrative Hearings. The board formally contracted with attorneys to act as hearing officers. The board now uses the Office of Administrative Hearings. Then in 2002, a bill was passed that required pre-need salesperson license renewal. Prior to that time, the licensee was a never-ending, everlasting, lifetime registration, and it's been a great benefit for the board. Since this bill passed, we used to have 1,600 licensed pre-need salespeople, and that number has now gone down to 200 because there were so many people who continued to have a registration, but they were no longer working in the business. As described above, the 2003 legislature reduced the board's limitation and eliminated one investigator position. I think I skipped a page. So I'll move on and talk about cost containment. The board has taken a number of actions, large and small, to contain costs. Included among them are establishing a website that saves postage, cuts down on long-distance telephone charges, and reduces the number of directories the board must print and deliver. The board also returned its permanently assigned Jeep to the motor pool, which eliminated the cost of a parking space as well. That particular change is estimated to save the board about $5,800. The board also disconnected a number of unused phone jacks that were causing unnecessary expense under the state's new flat rate billing system. That savings is estimated at $4,200. The board did things like obtain surplus filing cabinets rather than buying new for a savings of about $1,400. The board canceled trade publications and memberships, saving about $1,300. And we've taken other smaller actions that over time tend to provide larger savings, like combining expense reimbursement checks for board members that might be for $12, and we'll save them up and issue the board member one check on an annual basis rather than monthly checks. During the current biennium, the board also experienced considerable savings related to position vacancy factors. That was about $45,000. And the cancellation of one board meeting, which saved the board about $2,500. Those one-time savings stem from unique situations. As such, they will have no ongoing cost containment benefit. I don't know how much time I have. I think what I'm going to do is move on to major budgetary issues, because I think that's where the heart of the board's budget request lies. The board is not proposing any significant program growth or reduction. The central focus of the board's 2005-2007 budget proposal is to resolve an ongoing revenue shortfall and preserve its capacity to conduct legislatively mandated facility inspections and complaint investigations designed to protect the public. The board has been confronting the prospect of a revenue shortfall since the 1999 session, when the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development requested a determination from the board as to whether or not a fee increase was needed for the 2001-2003 biennium. During the 2001 session, the board reported that no fee increase was necessary. Although expenditures were expected to exceed revenues, the board felt its cash balance was sufficient to absorb the shortfall and begin the 2003-2005 biennium. The Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education agreed, noting that the board would most likely need a fee increase for the 2003-2005 biennium. The board's revenue is derived from two principal sources: license fees and a portion of the $7 death certificate filing fee. License fees at the time were last raised in 1993. The $5 portion of the filing fee that supports board programs had not been raised since the filing fee was first established in 1985.
With its cash balance depleted as anticipated, the board was compelled to eliminate only one of only two investigator positions from its 2003-2005 budget proposal. That would have been in required revenue shortfall package 070. In order to generate the revenue needed to restore the investigator position and retain sufficient cash balance, the board proposed a $7 increase in the death certificate filing fee. During the 2003 session, the Education Ways and Means Subcommittee rejected the filing fee increase proposal, instead directing the board to return to the emergency board with a license fee increase sufficient to fund the investigator position. In November of 2003, the board's request to appear before the emergency board with a license fee increase was denied, ostensibly because the Oregon Funeral Directors Association perceived the proposed increase to be too high. In January of 2004, the board and the Oregon Funeral Directors Association reached a compromise calling for a smaller license fee increase in combination with a smaller death certificate filing fee increase. In April of 2004, after the Department of Administrative Services approved the smaller license fee increase, the emergency board reviewed the revenue compromise and approved a budget limitation increase sufficient to restore the investigator position for the remainder of the current biennium. Interim license fee increases are automatically rescinded if they are not approved during the next legislative session. Since the board cannot yet recognize revenue from the interim license fee increase, and since the license fee increase represents only one half of the compromise, the board was again required to submit a revenue shortfall package. The board has only two investigators. This time, the revenue shortfall package proposes to reduce expenditures by eliminating both of them. House Bill 5037 contains the board's request for approval of the interim license fee increase. Senate Bill 53 proposes a $3 increase in the death certificate filing fee. Circumstances have changed considerably since the 2003 legislature rejected the board's last request for a filing fee increase. First, when the 2003 legislature considered the $7 increase, license fees had last been raised in 1993. This time, license fees were just raised last year. Second, the $3 increase proposed in 2005 is less than half of the $7 increase proposed in 2003. If enacted, the proposed filing fee increase and license fee increase will generate a combined total of about $280,000 in new revenue. Restoring the two investigator positions will cost about $222,000. In addition to the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, the license fee, filing fee, increase compromise has the support of other stakeholders, including the Cemetery Association of Oregon, the Oregon Funeral Consumers Alliance, which is a 14,000-member consumer advocacy group. The board is not aware of any opposition to the compromise. However, when I say opposition, I mean opposition from the board's stakeholders. I must confess that the idea of increasing the death certificate filing fee was rejected by this committee during the 2003 session, and it was further questioned by the emergency board subcommittee in April of 2004. The principal objection was that the filing fee is paid by consumers. It was recommended that the board align itself with other boards whose revenue is derived from fees paid by licensees rather than consumers. The conclusion that consumers pay the filing fee stems from a misconception that I hope I can dispel today. By rule and law, the funeral service practitioner who first assumes custody of the body is obligated to pay the filing fee, not the consumer. ORS 432.312 provides that the Department of Human Services shall impose and collect the filing fee. They do so by sending monthly invoices to the funeral home. Some funeral homes have a policy of not turning away any family, even when no one steps forward to take responsibility for the cost of arrangements. In those circumstances, the funeral director, not the family, is still obligated to pay the death certificate filing fee. The board has authority to sanction licensees who fail to pay the filing fee. The board has no authority to impose the filing fee on consumers, and it has no authority to impose sanctions on consumers who fail to pay the death certificate filing fee. So by rule and law, this is not a consumer-paid fee. This fee is paid by the board's licensees, and the Department of Human Services imposes and collects that fee through the issuance of monthly invoices to the licensees.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker, and then we'll have to get to public testimony.
Okay. I have a question about that, Mr. Coe, because my father-in-law passed away a couple years ago, and it was my first experience dealing with funerals and that sort of thing, and actually it was a very good and positive experience. But I recall that the death certificate fee was passed on to us. It may have been paid by the funeral director, but it was passed on to us to reimburse. Is that not correct?
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, as a practical matter, you will often see the death certificate filing fee on what's called the Statement of Funeral Goods and Services. It's typically in the same area as the price you may have paid for things like certified copies of the death certificate. Very often families need an original and a number of copies of death certificates in order to cash in insurance policies and do whatever else is necessary to probate an estate. Those fees are paid by consumers. The fees for purchasing certified copies of death certificates are paid by consumers. The filing fee is in that category very often as a practical matter, but it is not the consumer that is obligated to pay the death certificate filing fee. It's the funeral director. Now, perhaps the funeral home is simply informing consumers that this is a fee that they're paying and they're passing it through, but legally speaking, it's the licensee, not the consumer, who is required to pay the fee.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Mr. Chair, I may have been confusing that with all those death certificate fees because we had to get a number of them to, as you say, send them off here and send them off here to prove this person had died. And I'll go back and look, but I appreciate that you clarified that for me.
Chair Devlin, Senator Walker, I think if you went back and checked your contract, you very well might find under cash advance items, not under the things you're being charged for, but cash advance items, if I may, are items where the family might want flowers, the family might want to buy a cemetery plot. There are all sorts of things that families might want to buy from someone other than the funeral director. What the funeral home will do as a convenience to the people, the families that it serves, is that the funeral home or funeral director will make arrangements for the purchase of those items, and then they bill the family for what it costs them for those services. If the funeral home charges a service fee or gets a rebate or a kickback of any kind in providing that service, they are required by a federal regulation known as the funeral rule to state specifically that we charge you for our services in obtaining these items. So if you buy flowers and the flowers cost the funeral director $50, I can see. Thank you.
Okay. At this particular juncture, we only have about 10 minutes left this morning, so if we need to spend more time on this budget, which I think there are some questions about, we will do it during our next discussion. I will also delay the presentation by Mr. Gores until that future time. We have three bills up now that are actually for public hearing, 5036, 5037, and SB 53. I apologize to anybody that's come for 2058. Because we will not be opening a hearing on that this morning because there simply is not time. I will first call up the people that are here to testify, or the one person, on 5037, Chuck Roberts. Mr. Roberts, are you here? And if you could limit your testimony to about 2 to 3 minutes, it would be appreciated.
I'm Chuck Roberts, president of the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Oregon. We are consumer advocates. License fee increase and the death certificate fee are modest ones. We don't see a problem with that. And the reason I say this is that one way or another, the cost, any cost, is passed on to the consumer. And obviously, the funeral industry is in the process of making money. That's why they exist. And we understand that why that happens. Funeral Consumers Alliance of Oregon has about 10,000 members, and as president, I hear of problems our members have with at-death services. I am also on the board for Funeral Consumers Alliance, which is a national umbrella organization for over 100 organizations similar to the one in Oregon. And its 800 phone number receives an average of 500 calls a month. Half of these 250 calls are with people with complaints or concerns about the funeral industry. So I can say without question that the consumer wants regulation of the funeral industry and that the consumer is willing to pay for it. So I support passage of these two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Rumford. Now on SB 53, we have Mr. Cochran and Mr. Ordeman. Would you both come forward? And if you could each limit your testimony to 2 to 3 minutes each.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm a representative of the Cemetery Association of Oregon and a legislative liaison for that particular group. I'll make my testimony very short. I just want to let everyone know that the industry in general, Mr. Roberts and Mr. Ordeman, who's a representative of the Funeral Directors Association, kind of rare that we all come together along with the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board and are on the same page, but this is one of them that we are, and once again, the Cemetery Association has full support of this bill. And Mr. Ordeman, being from the cemetery side, we don't deal with the death certificate filing fee as much as his group would, so he may be able to answer some questions in regards to Senator Walker's questions on cash advances and maybe some of the Federal Trade Commission laws in regards to line items that she had.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wally Ordeman. I'm a fifth-generation funeral director from Albany and past president and current board member of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. In that role, I was asked to participate in, first, the task force which recommended a death certificate filing fee increase to generate funds for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and second, the task force which reached the compromise consensus on a modest filing fee increase as well as license fee increases to Oregon funeral homes and licensees. My testimony today is to encourage you to recognize the time, effort, and diligence this group of stakeholders invested in bringing this compromise package to you in the form of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board budget and subsequent plan for revenue increases. While the task force felt all along that a death certificate filing fee increase was the best funding mechanism for Mortuary and Cemetery Board revenue, we did our due diligence as instructed by the legislature and provided a compromise package which is acceptable to all of the parties that were involved. While no industry likes paying more in fees, it had been over 10 years since the last license fee increase to our state's licensees. And while any increases in small business fees are ultimately felt by the consumer, the task force's rationale justifying the death certificate filing fee increase is to provide a tangible mechanism for funeral homes to show these fees to its client families. In other words, license fee increases as a cost of doing business find their way to the consumer through general overhead charges, and funeral home operators are more likely to just add blanket amounts to their charges rather than calculating on a per case basis. The death certificate filing fee is typically shown on a contract as a direct pass-through to the client family. Therefore, the exact amount of the state's fee is being paid. It was the opinion of the work group that the industry cannot support any additional license fee increases should the filing fee increase be denied. The Oregon Funeral Directors Association recognizes the statutory mandate pressure that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board must abide by and recommends acceptance of the compromise package.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for either of the two people that are here? Hearing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else left to testify on 5036, 5037, or SB 53? I hope I got those numbers right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do note that Senate Bill 53 modifies Section ORS 432.312, which is also contained in House Bill 2058, and we might be able to put those together if we wanted to.
Well, thank you, Representative March. I've heard from some of your colleagues that you were been creative this last week. That might be another creative.
Well, I have some other creative ideas for 2058, Mr. Chair. But.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When the agency comes back, we'd like to have some additional discussion about policy package 070, which addresses revenue shortfall and the impact of eliminating both of the board's investigator positions. Again, this is a board that historically has been somewhat aggressive in dealing with violations and other serious consumer concerns. They've been doing their job, but if their ability to function in a manner that is going to impede them from continuing in the same professional manner, we need to hear how that's going to be addressed.
I agree, Senator Gordley. For the record, we will be bringing this agency back, both for a work session and probably for some additional discussion. Obviously, they're contained within the same bill, I believe, as many agencies, 5036. One of the things that's also very clear now is we do not know what the process is after this Thursday. So Mr. Coe may be brought back to two different committees at different times, because after Thursday we may be, it's very clear that we may be split into two separate budget committees, House and Senate. With that, I'm going to close.
There was another part to what I wanted to say, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
That it's clear that the only crime within the board's jurisdiction is engaging in certain death care activities without a license. That's according to the text we have in our notebooks. But I'd like to hear also, what is the range of sanctions available within the scope of the agency as you're dealing with violations?
And I might advise Mr. Coe that it might be beneficial to answer some of these questions in writing and get them to the committee so that we can ensure that they are clarified in the next hearing we have on this bill. With that, I'm going to close the hearing. Yes, Representative March.
Thank you. I want to follow up on a point I'd raised with one of the other health-related licensing boards, and that was the question of paying Social Security to the board's stipends, and whether there was a way that we could structure the payments to board members outside of the regular employment. I mean, we're paying Social Security for board members, and we should really have them paid as a stipend so there we don't have the accounting. It's 7.65%, but there is the accounting mechanism and such that we have to go through that I think could save the state a little bit of time and money.
We can have Ms. Manthi look at that. I think normally most of these boards, in terms of their what they're paid, many of them, I think, are paid $30 a day, which more appropriately could be considered a per diem, which shouldn't be under Social Security.
Correct.
With that, I will close the hearings on 5036, 5037, and SB 53, and close this committee meeting, and we will be here tomorrow morning for a public hearing on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
Is that 8:30 tomorrow?